knowing the history of that song gives me hope. Last night, First Parish board member Jill Borelli and I attended a fundraising dinner for Out Metro West, a program that seeks to support and save the lives of GLBTQ youth in Middlesex County. Our church, this church, you, were called out there and honored because we participate in this endeavor, because we house the Nexus program here for middle school youth. Ed Markey spoke there. What a record for human rights he has. Youth come from over 30 towns here every month to participate in Nexus. Because we are here, this healing work happens. A youth spoke there, and his mother spoke about how Out Metro West has literally saved his life. It occurred to me that I come to church to create healing like that. I come to church to be part of a bond with hope and not despair. So good for you, First Parish in Framingham, Unitarian Universalist. So this is a sermon about three words, Black Lives Matter. I want to say why these words do not offend me today, and I want you to consider how you feel about them. We are today starting an ongoing conversation about race at First Parish here today, meeting in the memorial room after the services at noon for lunch and conversation. No one has a full understanding about why we have not come further in healing racism in our country. Certainly I do not. I speak for myself today and invite you to do so as the days and months of our conversation proceed. Of course, all lives matter. Of course, all lives matter. This concept is core to Unitarian Universalism. White lives matter. Cops' lives matter. Black lives matter. Children's lives matter. Women's lives matter. GLBTQ lives matter. Rich people's lives matter. Poor people's lives matter. All lives matter, are sacred. Our first UU principle is that we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. It's not an easy task as the fallible human beings we are. I won't assume here today what race you identify with. We have learned that more and more people, no matter what they look like, are mixed race in some proportion. If we still subscribed to the 18th century idea that any amount of blood from a person of African descent makes a person African American, then many of us in this room would be black. Race is a social construct and has no biological basis any more than hair color or eye color does. Race is a construct that served the hierarchy upon which the powerful people of this nation controlled those who were stolen from other countries to provide labor. Each time we call ourselves white or black, we are reinforcing a concept that says some people matter more than others because of the stereotypes attached to the hierarchy and to the false racial concept. Coates, the author of the book I quoted in the reading, does not call white people white. He calls them those who think they are white. Nevertheless, it is almost impossible to not do so, use these adjectives or nouns in a sermon such as this. It's true, isn't it, that how we appear as to the color of our skin has everything to do with how concerned we are from day to day about racism in our land. Someone like me can be quite concerned about racism, and I am, as all of you here today are, I presume. Someone like me can deeply grieve the sorrow that lives in me about the injustice that racism still brings. But I can also not think about it, because the way things are here systemically and the implicit racism in the DNA of our society allows me to. I do not live my life in fear that the color of my skin makes it three times more likely that I will be killed by police. I do not automatically become a thief suspect when I enter a store. I don't have to worry about whether I can rent a place or buy a place because of how I look, the color of my skin. As painful as this issue is to me, I can take a break from its reality. I encourage you to read Coates' book, Between the World and Me. He's received the National Magazine Award, the Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism, and the George Polk Award for the Atlantic cover story called The Case for Reparations. It's powerful, it's difficult to read, as he shares his experiences and tries to relate to his son about them. Coates is afraid every day for his own and his son's physical survival. Between the World and Me is written for his son, as I said, and here are some words. And I am afraid. I feel the fear most acutely whenever you leave me. But I was afraid long before you, and in this I was unoriginal. When I was your age, the only people I knew were black, and all of them were powerfully, adamantly, dangerously afraid. I had seen this fear all my young life, though I had not always recognized it as such. It was always right in front of me. The fear was there in the extravagant boys of my neighborhood, in their large rings and medallions, their big puffy coats and full-length fur-colored leathers, which was the armor against their world. They stood on the corner. I think back on those boys now, and all I see is fear. And all I see is them girding themselves against the ghosts of the bad old days when the Mississippi mob gathered round their grandfathers so that the branches of the black body might be torched, then cut away. The fear lived on in their practiced bop, their slouching denim, their big T-shirts, the calculated angle of their baseball caps, a catalog of behaviors and garments enlisted to inspire the belief that these boys were in firm possession of everything they desired. I say this next to people here today who identify as white. It is not our fault as white people that we have privilege, but it is a fact. And having privilege does not mean that we don't suffer, that we don't have financial problems or get bullied for things, or any of it. It means that because of the racial history of our country and how it has been institutionalized, and because of the roots of unconscious implied racism that lives in each of us, all kinds of studies bear this out, we have privilege and others do not. Let me give you an example from my own life of how privilege played out. When my son was in third grade, it was the tradition in the tiny town of Fairhaven, New Jersey, every third grade year, to have the students dress up in period clothes and learn the Virginia Reel as a way to learn about colonial America. Parents came to see it. After the dancing, there was a lunch served of food that would have been common fare in colonial America. America. So I went, unassuming, to see my son dressed up and dancing. But here's the thing. He is African American, and he would not have been in this circumstance back in the day. He would have been harvesting the food and preparing it and serving it, not because he chose to, but because he would have been a slave. In this mostly white hamlet of high-income people living the American dream, there was really no conscious awareness of what they were leaving out. No discomfort that this little boy was asked to act out the story that was not his, that disregarded the backs upon which this dream has been built. They were not trying to be insensitive. They were repeating the story they had been taught, ensconced in tradition, and colonialism was projected as something to dance about. And this is how white privilege works. The organization that has named itself Black Lives Matter has chosen a name that is uncomfortable for some people. We have these words out on our wayside pulpit, and they've been there through the summer. And we did get an anonymous call that threatened that if we did not take it down, someone would do it for us. This man went on to say, it was in a message, I didn't speak directly, that he comes from a family of policemen, and that he could not believe that we would want to be so divisive. Here then, in his anger and in his unwillingness to do anything other than threaten, we have an example of the chasm of misunderstanding that can arise out of the very different experiences of people in America. He did not leave a name or a number, which was unfortunate because I would have loved to speak with him. I might have invited him here this morning and had a dialogue with him. I would have told him why I believe the words Black Lives Matter are not trying to say what he thinks they are. That the words Black Lives Matter do not mean that white lives don't matter. That the life of police people don't matter. The statement, Black Lives Matter, is not an anti any other group presentation. Rather, these words are meant to convey that in our country, there are many realities that show that white lives matter more than black lives. The words are meant to urge us to be in pursuit of our stated American ideal of equal justice and equal protection under the law. The goals of Black Lives Matter are not to harass the police, not to say that all lives don't matter, but to bring awareness to changes that have to be made in the way justice and law is administered in this country. The facts. Black Americans are more than twice as likely to be unarmed when killed during encounters with police as white people. According to an investigation which found 102 of 464 people killed so far this year in incidents with law enforcement officers were not carrying weapons. 32% of them were black. 32% of black people killed by police this year so far were unarmed, as were 25% of Hispanic and Latino people, compared to 15% of white people killed. The figures illustrate how disproportionately black Americans, who make up just 13% of the population, according to census data, are killed by police. Of the 464 people counted by the Guardian Research Project, an overwhelming majority, 95%, were male, with just 5% female. And despite what Fox News has reported, the war on cops is a fallacy statistically. Cops, police people, have a hard life. I sat with Framingham police people at the Framingham Coming Together event, the last one, and heard how scared police people are daily for their lives because they walk into difficult, sometimes impossible situations. Most of them do fantastic work. But according to research by the American Enterprise Institute, Using statistics from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, 2015 is on track to be one of the safest years for police officers in recorded history. And those statistics have been gathered since 1870. Only the year 2013 might hedge it out as safer, with fewer assaults or killings of police officers. If you look at the rate of murder of police officers, the trend is even steeper. This follows a significant downward trend in recent decades. Under President Obama, there have been 46% fewer killings of police officers this year than at the same point in President Reagan's presidency. By any statistic, not perception, not how people fear, there is no war on cops. I do believe from what I've read that it's the media that has perpetrated this idea. But they're doing it not to generate sympathy for hardworking police officers. If they truly cared about police officers, they would shine the light on compensation and benefits. They would look at job-related health issues and stress-related heart trouble. But I believe the intent of that media story is to discredit the Black Lives Matter movement. When someone says to me that more blacks are murdered by other blacks, it's called euphemistically black-on-black murder, than by police people, I do not understand why this should justify the statistics I just cited. Does this then mean that it's okay for those with power over others to distribute that power unevenly based on skin color? Are we supposed to then grimace about how they are killing each other and somehow think it dilutes the immense problem we have with how justice is served? The fact that any people are killing any people is of concern. The fact that poverty and addiction and despair live increasingly in our economically challenged inequality in this country, how those things live with vigor in communities of color, is what we should be grieving about in this land of the free, founded on the backs of the unfree. And that pain, that tragedy, is what we are grappling with still. It takes different forms, not the least of which is the number of people of color incarcerated in this country, in prisons that operate for profit, which make it unconsciously expedient to fill them. President Obama is doing a show on the prison industry this evening at 9 o'clock. In reading about this, I read about an obscure word. It was in a book about obscure words to describe people. The word is eucalegon, eucalegon. A eucalegon is a neighbor whose house is on fire. The writer goes on to say that we would not tell the 911 operator that we are reporting a eucalegon or a eucalegon. No. When a neighbor's house is on fire, you don't mess around with the meaning of words. You show up and find out what you can do. When we, as privileged people, criticize the name of a movement for justice, we are diverting the attention to our discomfort instead of trying to understand what the movement is about, instead of listening to the pain and the fear in our neighbors' lives. Our neighbors' houses are on fire, and they are us, and we are called. All lives matter. Perhaps adding the word T-O-O to Black Lives Matter would be helpful. Before we can say that our society acts as if all lives do matter, there is much conversation to be had, much listening to be done, much willingness to move on to an awareness that aligns itself not with the comfort and privilege of some, but with the spiritual knowledge that when hate burns one house, it burns all houses. Our seventh principle as Unitarian Universalists calls us to live from the knowledge that existence is an interdependent web. While those of us who think we are white can rest in our safety and privilege, we do so at great peril for our nation and for our souls. In our conversations in the weeks and months ahead, we'll try to figure out how we can help. Learn the facts, connect with the movement perhaps in some way, support, look at our own lives and assess, engage in some way, and to do what one author called stay woke, W-O-K-E, stay woke. Stay awake to what we don't know from the lens of our own experience and be willing to learn it. So I end today because I think many of you here have worked for justice and equality all of your lives and feel perhaps weary sometimes and as if there hasn't been progress when, in fact, of course, there has. But it's not over yet. So these are Beatitudes for Justice Builders. Blessed are you who can question your own assumptions and listen with an open mind. You will receive new insights beyond your imagining, and they will liberate you. Blessed are you who suffer the attacks of others to stand up for what is right. You will not be alone, for your courage will inspire others to rise. Blessed are you who build friendships as well as justice with people you ordinarily wouldn't. Even when you lose an issue, you will have strengthened the foundation of your community. Blessed are you who agitate the placid waters of complacency, who will create waves in the inertia of privilege and will know the thrill of riding the surf of change. Blessed are you who lead with enthusiasm and confidence, resisting the temptation to shame the apathetic or self-absorbed. You will inspire curiosity and hope in others. Blessed are you who do not demonize your opponents. Your eyes and your hearts will be open. And blessed are you who sing and dance. You will find energy and joy to lift you on your journey. So out of Hebrew scripture, let us sing our final hymn today.